Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Another goal with enhancing international trade, which is fundamental to expand markets at home as well as to global food security.
That's Deputy Ag Secretary Sochil Torres-Small providing highlights from the G20 Ag Ministers meeting held in Brazil.
Making food systems more inclusive by expanding opportunities for small-scale farmers, women, youth, indigenous people, and other underrepresented groups. And during the course of the meeting, I had the chance to share more with my counterparts about how USDA is fostering more resilient local and regional food production, ensuring access to safe, healthy, and nutritious food, fostering innovation to develop more sustainable climate-smart production practices, and promoting trade policies that enable the adoption of such practices.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Yeah, actually, in the history of our country, we've never passed the Farm Bill in an election year, presidential election year.
Dr. Joe Outlaw is co-director of the Agricultural Food Policy Center at Texas A&M.
And so probably that's a strike against getting it done later this fall when there's a window after the election before the Congress turns over that people are pointing to that we have a window there to potentially get a farm bill done. And I just don't think that, I just point to history, and we've never been able to do that time period either. So I truly believe that the farm bill will move into early next year. I think probably, and this is news to a lot of people, but I think probably some sort of what I call financial disaster assistance will be passed this year. Much more likely for that to happen than the farm bill to get done. And that will be immediate relief within the next few months for people who are suffering because of these low prices and high input costs that they're dealing with.
And it's not because the bill isn't agreed to. Actually, most of it is done.
I think the staff that are working on it, I know many of them personally, would say that the bill's 80% done with total agreement, all sides. But it's that last 20% where it's as caustic an environment as there has ever been, with politics really ruling the day. There's no doubt in my mind, if it wasn't an election year, we'd already have a farm bill. In election years, neither party leadership wants to let the other party get any perceived success. And that's where we're at. And it sounds like dealing with children, but that's kind of the way it's working right now.
But when it comes to negotiating a new farm bill, there are absolute non-negotiables.
The number one thing is the safety net for row crop producers, because of the increase in the costs, has to be increased. What does that mean? That means that the protection levels need to be ratcheted up. And in the House bill, they're ratcheted up really quite nicely. It costs money to do that. But honestly, if we don't do that one thing, we shouldn't even do a bill. But there are other things that need to be changed as well. So the safety nets for row crop producers is a big deal. But on the conservation side, there are some changes that need to be made. On the crop insurance side, there needs to be enhancements to make things a little bit more affordable so that people in Texas, which has a lot of risk, can afford to buy coverage and cover more of their to share more of their risk with the government. Most people in the state probably don't realize this, but For a Texan to buy the same level of coverage, meaning that they're getting more protection that the Midwest guys do for $6, would cost us closer to $40 an acre. And that is all because we have so much weather risk. There's not anything, there's no conspiracy. It's just the way the numbers work. Well, there's some products that they can do that will allow Texans to go ahead and get higher levels of coverage, and those are in this bill. So we need that done as well.
Dr. Joe Outlaw, longtime farm policy expert with the Agriculture Food Policy Center. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Yeah, it sure feels, Tony, like we're on kind of the downside of what is historically a pretty cyclical market.
Tom Sell is a farm policy expert with Combest Sell and Associates.
We had good farm income in 21. In 22, it was record, again, helped in a big way by some federal assistance that was still carrying over into 22. And, of course, we had very high prices at that time. We also had very high input costs. But it you know, on the macro stats for the nation, it was a record net farm income year. Came down significantly in 23, but still by historical standards pretty high. But then in 24, it has just kind of fallen off the cliff, particularly for traditional row crops. You know, the corn, the beans, the wheat, the cotton that make up roughly 250 million acres. This is the bulk of our crop acreage in the nation. These are the kind of foundational crops, the staple crops, as we used to call them, that are so important to the ag economy in so many ways. It really bleed through the system in so many ways. And when the farmers of those very important crops are all in the red, we got a problem as a nation. And this is where historically farm bills have come in to provide some help. Unfortunately, the 18 farm bill, as it's currently structured, really doesn't have any help. There is going to be precisely zero payments out of the FSA from ARC or PLC in October of this year at a time when it is terribly needed. And that's why I think it's really, that's why these groups are all coming to Washington, D.C. saying, you know, now is the time we need a farm bill right now.
But finding new trade partners may be difficult. John Kavalik is with the U.S.-Cuba Trade and Economic Council on the long-term effects of Havana Syndrome.
In terms of, you know, was China behind Havana Syndrome or whatever, you know, I don't know. But, you know, it everything is interconnected because you know, there is a general belief among Washington people that if Cuba did it, they probably weren't alone or they allowed someone else. And so then you get, you know, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea. So then it starts, okay, how do we want to deal with China? How do we want to deal with Russia? And so they all, you know, create this bullion base of unpleasantness and everything gets mixed together. And it's hard to, you know, it's hard to extract. In 2021, you know, basically 5 months into Biden's term, after during the campaign, he had said that he was inclined to reverse some of what Trump had done, which was a reversal of some of what Obama had done. And 5 months in, the Cubans arrest a lot of people, basically make it impossible for the Biden administration to politically do what it was going to do without it being seen as rewarding bad behavior. And they got, you know, beaten up by, you know, some of the organizations and voter groups who said, hey, you promised this. And the Biden folks said, yeah, how can we possibly reward them? So that's a part of this where, you know, Havana Syndrome and then arresting people. And then, you know, after the Russia invades Ukraine and Cuba, because it needs Russia, is basically, you know, sort of siding with Russia. And then Israel war in Gaza and the Cuba is, even though there have been Israeli companies that have been important players in Cuba, they're very much, you know, against Israel. So it, you know, they're always doing or saying something that makes it tough.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I could see it having some kind of impact, generally speaking.
Bob Bowers with Manduca Trading in Chicago on the potential of a rate cut by the Federal Reserve.
Recall correctly, the market is handicapping the odds of a 50 basis point move, hike that is, at about 55% chance and a 25 basis point move at 100% chance. So if they don't do anything, it would be a huge shocker to the market, I think. And there would be some quick repricing and some rethought about what's really going on in the Fed's head and our ability, meaning all the analysts out there, to deem what's going on in the Fed's head. But let's just say they do 25 to 50 basis points. If they do 25, I think that's already priced into the market. I don't see a whole lot of movement. But if they do 50, being that the handicapping right now is about 55% of those out there, or there's about a 55% chance, shall we say, of a 50 basis point hike. That means half would be super surprised that is a 50 basis point move and half wouldn't. And I think that kind of means to me that, Nat, if you follow that logic, is that there'd be more surprise or more of an impact if they do 50 basis points, because you got 100% chance of 25 basis points. You got about 50% chance of 50 basis points. So net, net, bigger surprise if they do 50, and definitely a big surprise if they do nothing. All right. So that aside, how would that impact the markets? Well, just generally speaking, looking from the 30,000 foot view, shall we say, I would say that the more accommodative the Fed turns in terms of their policy, the happier consumers will be. The happier consumers will be tends to be a bit of a bullish input in terms of our commodity markets. So put all that together, and I would think you might get, at least from that one aspect, meaning FOMC policy and potential moves and directions for the interest rates, as being a bullish element, and we'll see how that plays in. So I guess if you are already bullish some of these grains and oil seeds and the livestock markets that we talk about, that wouldn't hurt you. You know, so we'll see how that plays out. It's kind of a big picture element. I would say, though, that in my opinion, when the Fed starts to move in one direction, they, at least for a short spell, meaning over a series of meetings, I'm not talking consecutive meetings, I'm just talking about, you know, the trend over time, would be for them to continue to move that way, absent any kind of new catalyst coming around to really make them hit the brakes again, meaning pause, and not make another move in the shorter term, versus, you know, flipping back and forth and tightening. Definitely not that side. But I would say that if this becomes the new normal, where over some period of time, let's just say within the next year, we might expect another decrease in rates, you know, that would be a friendly element, and that could play its way into obviously bond prices. That's a natural, but also the psychology for the equity market too. Meaning that, you know, the lower interest rates would help things out in terms of trader psychology and being more accommodative for companies out there. So you might see the equity markets pop up, which kind of we talk about, you know, every couple few weeks or so, as being one of the elements in terms of a wealth effect and whether or not people feel pretty good about their 401ks and whether or not that trickles down into how they spend their dollars at the end of the month. And that means how much they're spending at the grocery stores and whether or not they can buy the higher end of cuts of meat, for example. So we'll see how that plays out. So yes, I definitely think it'll have an impact if it's like beyond 25 basis points, or if they do nothing, like they hold off for the next meeting.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
What happens over time is you tend to have input suppliers say they know their producers, and they hold the line as best they can on cost increases.
At some point, these prices have to converge. Dr. Joe Outlaw, co-director of the Agriculture Food Policy Center.
And then when you have a period like we did the last 6 years ago, then ended about 3 years ago, where prices were relatively high, we had most of our input suppliers took that opportunity to go ahead and move up and move up their prices. And what we find is that commodity prices on the row crop side have really come down, and the input supply prices haven't. And so that's what we call a cost price squeeze in economics, where the price of the output has fallen, but the cost of the production has not. And it puts producers in a squeeze, as you'd say. And so that is a message I've been carrying to Washington for the last year. They're very well aware of the problem. And that's why I do think we'll probably get some sort of assistance before the end of the year. Maybe in a farm bill, but more likely in a appropriations bill.
And part of the reason for the lower prices, more competition. Why has the U.S. lost market share?
More than ever. The U.S. used to be the breadbasket of the world. Corn and beans were the cheapest to produce in the United States in the Corn Belt area. And I can't say that anymore. Brazil is converted a lot of land into crop production, and they have the same technologies that we do, often without the environmental constraints that we have, often with cheaper input prices than we have. and for the same seeds and inputs. So really our advantage of tremendous weather and deep soils in the Midwest have been, we're not that advantaged anymore, if at all. And so why that matters is because nationally, corn and beans account for about 175 million acres of land. And when those two crops aren't profitable, those producers start planting other things like cotton, like wheat, like rice, where they have the land, the resources to do so. And that drives their prices down. So it affects everybody that we are seeing more competition and stouter competition than we've ever had.
But if there's been anything positive in all of this, it's actually been the cattle market.
The cattle market is one of the few bright spots in all of U.S. agriculture. And it is not just a fluke. It's not just because a lot of people point to the fact that the cattle herd is the smallest since the 50s. But it's the demand is also very strong for beef, for U.S. beef. And we consume the large majority of our production stays in the country. And so we're not dependent upon someone to buy it from us. Our consumers have continued to pay as prices have increased for the finished products. Consumers have continued to pay. So the demand has stayed strong, even in the face of some of the highest prices we've ever had for cattle. So, that is the bright spot. And, the experts in this area tell me, and we're in agreement that, there's always something that could happen that could cause it to change, but right now, at least for the next few years, we don't expect it to change drastically.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Consider this as well, our competitors in China, as well as elsewhere in the world. They don't care about regulations or environmental permitting. When they want to build it, they just do it, with little, if any, regard to the environment.
A member of the House Ag Committee and chairman of the House Subcommittee on Water Resources and Environment, North Carolina's David Rouser.
Now, while we do not want to adopt their mentality, nor would we should not put meaningless delays on critical infrastructure projects like manufacturing, housing, or very critical energy projects. As I've stated many times before, regulations should be simple and easy to follow. The benefit of that is they should carry out the intent of the law in a clear and transparent manner, making them easy to enforce. There should be no subjectivity or wiggle room for any bureaucrat to substitute their own biases or interpretations. But unfortunately, that's certainly not been the case with the Clean Water Act.
Illinois Representative Mike Bost is the chairman of both committees as well, with Courtney Briggs, chair of the Waters Advocacy Coalition.
So now here we are, a year into the Biden administration's new WOTUS ruling, and nothing's changed. There's been no regulatory clarity, no real guidance, no communication with the public. While the administration may be okay with this, there are serious implications for our landowners and industry stakeholders. Ms. Briggs, you noted in your written testimony that landowners can be fined up to $64,000 per day or receive jail time for any clean water violation. I'll repeat that again. $64,000 are jail time. That's not small change for a simple mistake or a misunderstanding. That's devastating to any landowner or small business. Now, Ms. Briggs, from a farming perspective, can you speak to the challenges that the farmers have faced under this administration's poorly amended WOTUS rule, and how easily it may be for a landowner to make a simple mistake and be in violation and look at $64,000 a day in jail time?
Yeah, I mean, after the Biden administration's rulemaking came out, then after Sackett, then after the conforming rule, it was at a fever pitch. The amount of confusion and concern and uncertainty that we were hearing from our members. And it is incredibly easy for our members right now under this regulatory regime to unknowingly break the law and be subject to all of those penalties that can frankly put a member out of business. I mean, we represent so many small businesses who don't have the ability to absorb that kind of those kind of costs. And it's $64,000 per day for every non-compliance on the farm field. So that can add up quickly, and it can be absolutely devastating. But with this level of uncertainty, it is unfair to our landowners. And again, I just don't understand why the agencies won't come out, clearly tell landowners what the rules of the road are. It's like I like to take my kids to the pool every now and then, and it's like that pool sign where it says all the rules, and it's, you know, no jumping, no splashing, no glass. And then at the bottom it says, you know, if you violate these rules, then you will lose your membership to the pool. Well, imagine that is the sign for our landowners, but all of the rules have been blacked out. And at the bottom it says you could be subject to $64,000 a day or jail time. It just doesn't square.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Well, the expectations would be for the normal tendency for those numbers to persist.
Bob Maurer is with Manduca Trading in Chicago, looking at what the trade is looking for in the September Cattle on Feed report, which comes out Friday after the close.
I know there's been some misses this year in terms of the placements number in particular being higher than expected and beyond, say, the initial range of expectations a few times over this year already. And I think that that's still a possibility, but nonetheless, I would imagine that we'll probably come in pretty close to the trend, which would be just a bit lower month on month. So we'll see how that works its way into the marketplace, and if it does. In terms of the bigger picture for cattle and beef, and kind of segueing from what we just talked about with the wealth effect and what could happen with interest rates and working its way into the psychology of consumers, you know, beef is not cheap. And when you compare the price of a pound of a better cut of steak compared to, say, pork or either chicken or turkey, you're definitely stretching the dollars. You know, it's more expensive. Let's put it that way, without coming up with some bigger analogy. It's just more expensive. So we really need to see consumer demand stay fairly strong, and it's heavily reliant on that for the cattle prices. Because if you walk up to the shelf at the grocery store and you see, you know, pork and, like I said, chicken and turkey trading, you know, being offered a bit lower, and things are a little bit tighter back at home, you know, you might lean towards not beef. So we need to see consumer demand stay strong. We need to see that come around. The supply and demand report that came out last week showed that the combined supply of chicken, pork, and beef in 2024 is currently estimated about 211.5 pounds per person, and that is about 3.7% or almost 2% higher than a year ago. So there's plenty of product out there, which again kind of argues the fact that we need to see demand stay pretty strong. Now, demand kind of works its way into the marketplace that we watch week on week by what's happening out there in the cash cattle land, and that's been a little bit softer of late, right? Now, so the first calf run, the fall calf run, I should say, is starting to put a little bit of pressure on the cattle prices at the auction, and that's working its way into the cash side of the equation. I mean, the market did hold pretty steady last week with the trade in the north at about 288, which was steady week on week, and the trade at 181 in the south last week, which was steady week on week. So it was good that the cash stayed steady, but nonetheless, you know, you might anticipate it falling back a bit unless, again, the demand can hold up pretty good, because there's plenty of supply out there based on what the WASDE report said last week, at least here in the United States. So we'll see how that all plays out. If you look at the charts, the December live cattle basically stuck in a range of about 179.5 down to about 173.5. So about a $6 range seems to be content right there. We'll see if some catalyst comes around to push that thing out of there. And then also for feeder cattle sitting around 228 up to about 238. So about a $10 range in that market also. And again, maybe the reports, you know, maybe the cattle on feed report will offer some kind of surprise that'll help, you know, knock it out of this range. But for right now, it seems pretty comfortable in there.
Again, that's Bob Maurer, Manduca Trading in Chicago, online, myfuturesadvisor.com. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
A simple message to Brazil regarding future partnership in sustainable aviation fuel industry development, according to Agriculture Deputy Secretary Sochil Torres Small.
One of my priorities coming in is ensuring that Brazil gets the message that we want to work together on sustainable aviation fuel, but we have to be at a level playing field.
The Deputy Secretary at the G20 Agricultural Ministerial in Brazil, telling reporters Friday.
Right now, the United States has a 2% tariff ethanol coming in from Brazil, but they've leveled an unfair and unjust 18% tariff on our ethanol.
A pre-G20 meeting allowed U.S. corn and soybean industry representatives opportunity to share frustrations about Brazilian tariffs and how it hinders the expansion of sustainable aviation fuel opportunities globally.
We're not asking Brazil to buy a billion gallons of U.S. ethanol. We just want them to treat our products the same manner that we treat theirs.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.